Today is Tuesday, April 26th. We're going to work on reproductive information today.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about making sperm and making eggs. It's a process that's almost identical in males and females, but you'll notice the end results tend to vary. So we end up making 4 sperm from 1 stem cell. And for females, we end up making only 1, ultimately, what's going to be an egg cell. So you wonder why there's a difference. Why do we make 4 sperm cells and only 1 egg cell? And it has to do with the size of that egg cell. The egg cell is actually the largest cell in the human body. It is barely visible on the top of a pinhead. And ironically, the sperm cells are the smallest cells in the human body. But it's not the size of the sperm cells that's the issue. It's making that egg big enough to last on a 7-day trip without any kind of outside help. It has to have cytoplasm and organelles and stored sugars to be able to drift and reproduce and divide for 7 days from the fallopian tube down to the uterus where implantation should take place. So that's why it has to be a large cell. And all these other cells actually donate their cytoplasm and organelles to that cell. So what I need to do is give you some background information. I know you've been through Bio-210, but I'm not sure how comfortable you are with terminology like chromosomes that are single-stranded and double-stranded. So that's going to be part of our conversation today. And we're going to go through mitosis and meiosis, so we need to understand the differences between these types of chromosomes. This particular chromosome here looks like a single airplane propeller. It is called a single-stranded chromosome. And you can have 23 of these, or you can have 46 of these, but the catch is they're not replicated. They're not ready to undergo cell division. The double-stranded chromosome that looks like an X or a butterfly is ready to undergo cell division. So it has 2 chromatid arms on top, 2 identical chromatid arms on the bottom, and it is ready to undergo cell division and be separated. And likewise, you can have 23 double-strandeds or 46 double-strandeds. But when you say double-stranded, you're indicating that those are ready to be divided into 2 or, you know, more new cells. Sometimes we see the chromosomes pair up with their identical partners, and we call their identical partners homologs. A homologous chromosome pairs up with its homolog only during meiosis. Okay, in this picture I've drawn them as double-stranded, and what does that tell you they're ready for? They're ready for cell division, yeah, so. But the fact is, we don't see those homolog pairs partner up unless we're ready to undergo meiosis. Otherwise, there's no point in having your partners get together. So homologous chromosomes are going to be important for, you know, division of sex cells. All right. Something else to notice is diploid versus haploid. That too is going to be part of our conversation today. Diploid cells are ones that carry 2 sets of chromosomes, and we represent it using a shorthand of 2N. N means a set or population of chromosomes. 1N, just a single N, means that there's only 1 set of chromosomes, and that's what haploid cells carry. So if you think about it, di as a prefix means 2, 2N is 2 sets. I think about hap or half the number of chromosomes for a haploid cell. So diploid cells are those body cells. Pretty much every body cell in your body has 46 total chromosomes. We could sample a liver cell, a hair cell, a skin cell. They're going to all be diploid in nature, carrying 46 total chromosomes. The only cells that we could sample with 23 total chromosomes are sex cells, egg and sperm. Why do you think sex cells need half the normal number of chromosomes?
Because they go
from
other half of other persons.
Good.
To make 46 for the baby.
That's right. So you got 23 from mom and 23 from dad. They make 46 for the new baby. That's right. So if we started off with 46 chromosomes in our sex cells, and that's what we allowed to be fertilized during reproduction, we'd end up with what? Something like 92 chromosomes?
That'd be a hot mess.
That'd be a hot mess, yeah. And in fact, if that were to happen, the body would abort that pregnancy before you ever even knew you were pregnant. So that's just an unviable fertilization event. So we got to have that chromosome count reduced by half. So that takes us to talking about meiosis. It is a special type of reproduction.
only reserved for sex cells. We don't use meiosis to make clones of body cells. Instead, we use it to reduce the chromosome count down by half for sex cells. So I'd like to talk to you about spermatogenesis there on page 129. And I'm going to start with a stem cell here called a spermatogonium. Males start making sex cells at around puberty. So, you know, it's around ages 11 to 14. Of course, those ages can be variable depending on the person. But at puberty, we start seeing a spike in gonadotropic releasing hormone. Where does GnRH come from?
Hypothalamus,
good. You ready for the final?
There you go.
Kudos to you.
Yeah. Where do releasing hormones target?
Anterior pituitary.
Good. Okay. And the anterior pituitary makes follicle stimulating hormones and luteinizing hormones. These hormones work together in conjunction. They're kind of like a tag team. One of these hormones will encourage testosterone production in male testes. And if you want to flip with me, I'll tell you where you can read this. Flip over to 130, and you'll see that on the very top of the page there. LH encourages testosterone production. But FSH encourages spermatogenesis. Okay. So you have to have testosterone for spermatogenesis to occur properly. That's why I mentioned these two hormones are kind of working as a tag team. So around puberty, GnRH turns on FSH and LH. LH travels to the testes and turns on production of testosterone. FSH tells male testes to start maturing these spermatogonia. So spermatogonia undergo mitosis. And how many cells are typically made from mitosis? Two cells. And so it may look a little funny here because I've only got one cell drawn. The other cell actually returns to the stem cell line. It's going to continue making more spermatogonia. So we actually take, we rob one of those daughter cells away and return it back to the stem cell line. So I'll just make that note here. A spermatogonium is a body cell. It is a diploid cell. So should I represent it as 1N or 2N? It's 2N. Cells that undergo mitosis are identical clones to their parent cells. So should we call that primary spermatocyte a diploid cell or a haploid cell? It's identical to its parent. It is diploid. Yeah. So in that primary spermatocyte, the chromosomes will line up with their homologous pair. We have 23 pairs of chromosomes, so those 23 pairs will partner up. Chromosome number one finds its buddy, chromosome number one, and this happens all the way down the line to the 23rd pair, which are sex cells. All right, so this primary spermatocyte will undergo two more cell divisions. The first cell division is called meiosis I. So I'm going to draw a little picture out here to the side. This is our starting chromosome appearance. We've got homologous chromosomes in our primary spermatocyte. When we undergo meiosis I, we split off those chromosomes. Now each cell will only have one of those pairs. So what do you think happens to our chromosome count?
They're half.
They're half, yeah. So what do we call these secondary spermatocytes?
Haploid.
They're haploid cells, yeah. What does this double-stranded chromosome tell you? It's ready for what?
Division.
So we need to undergo yet one more meiosis round of cell division, and that's what we're going to do next. That secondary spermatocyte will undergo meiosis II. And finally, we see spermatids.
So if I take 23 double-stranded chromosomes and just split off their extra set, that extra arm and leg there, so to speak, I still have 23 chromosomes in our spermatid nuclei. I just happen to have a haploid set of single-stranded chromosomes. So that's all we did. We still have haploid cells as we go through meiosis II. We just stripped off that extra set of DNA. So that's kind of where we need to be in terms of our DNA. So how many spermatids are made from one spermatogonium?
Four.
If you do the math here, in a day's time, one male can produce around 100 to 200 million sperm in a day's time. So you know, that's impressive. And imagine if all of those could result in a pregnancy.
Oh my goodness.
We'd be living on Mars and Venus and would be floating around in outer space.
Yeah. Like every planet would be inhabited.
It would be. Yeah. Riding our little space scooters everywhere.
Every planet would be a
It would be too, yeah. So why in the world make so many sperm?
Because only one gets there.
Some of them are defective.
Some are defective.
Yeah.
Some are killed.
Yeah,
it is. So female vaginal fluids can kill sperm. You know, you're right, there are some defective ones. Some of them never make it to the egg. Some actually commit suicide by ramming their heads against the egg to break down the membrane.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
that's dedication.
Going to battle, you're going to... Today's your day, right?
No doubt trying.
So from the beginning point to making sperm is 10 weeks. Yes, 2.5 months to get from the spermatogonium to the sperm. This last process is not actually cell division. From a spermatid to an actual viable swimming sperm is about 20 days. That process is called spermiogenesis, and it occurs in the epididymis.
Say that part again.
Sure. This last process here is not cell division. It's a streamlining process. And it occurs during the last 20 days of those 10 weeks. It's called spermiogenesis. It occurs in the epididymis.
Okay.
Sure. So you'll notice those spermatids are round, typical cells. They don't look like they're ready to swim to an egg. What we need to do is streamline them and trim them down. So pretty much all the cytoplasm is stripped out of the cell, and we're left only with the nucleus. That is what we call the head of the sperm. That's where the DNA is housed. You know, if today's your day, sperm, if you're going to go into battle today to fight for that egg, you got to wear a helmet. And this helmet is called an acrosome. I'm going to put a party hat on it. We save the best to last, right? And boy, is that a helmet. It's an explosive helmet. It contains lysosomes and enzymes that help to break down the female's egg membrane, because one sperm has to penetrate through the egg's membrane. So all these other sperm actually rupture against the membrane to help break it down, and they do so by releasing those enzymes from the acrosome. They're committing suicide. They're going to ram headfirst against the membrane, the enzymes rupture, and that sperm dies. So they may be good swimmers, but you know, they're not going to be the one that fertilizes the egg. And of course, sperm need a flagellum to swim. Some sperm have two flagella. It doesn't really matter if they have two, because that part breaks off. The only thing that goes into the egg is the head or the DNA portion. And so the mid-piece there has got mitochondria. That's what powers that flagellum and allows it to move like a whip. So from the top, males start producing sperm around ages 11 to 14. We're looking at the years for puberty. When hormone levels begin to increase, we start seeing testosterone made as a result of LH. And we start seeing spermatogenesis begin as a result of FSH. Those spermatogonia undergo mitosis. Mitosis produces two identical cells. One of them goes back to the stem cell line to keep up the population. We're going to follow the other cell, though, called a primary spermatocyte. You'll notice those chromosomes partner up with their homologous pair, and we now strip away the extra DNA into two cells. So we separate those homologs into two cells. Since these cells are haploid, how many chromosomes does each cell have?
23.
23, good. And these secondary spermatocytes are still in the testes. They undergo meiosis too. We're going to take those double-stranded chromosomes and strip them down to make them single-stranded. So we end up with spermatid that are haploid now with single-stranded chromosomes. The problem with the spermatid is not ready to swim, so it spends the next 20 days in the epididymis, traveling about a foot per day, becoming a streamlined sperm. So sperm have an acrosome headpiece with enzymes, a tail for swimming, and they've lost that extra cytoplasm that weighs them down. Young men's sperm can make its way to the egg in about 45 minutes. So if a female has ovulated, you know, within 45 minutes, the sperm can reach the egg. Sperm can live for about 2 days, at maximum 3 days. So if a female, what's today, Thursday, if a female ovulates today, it's possible she could have had sex as early as Monday, have sperm still in her reproductive tract that could fertilize the sperm today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Scary.
That was not an agreeable toy.
So, question: the spermatoid, where it becomes a single chromosome, is that where the defect would happen? If there was a fake defect from the male that, like, the child had a defect, is that where it would happen?
It's a chromosomal abnormality.
Like when the 23rd chromosome had a defect, I think it was called the Down syndrome or something like that. Would it happen there?
It would probably happen. If I'm not mistaken, I want to say it's here between primary and secondary.
Oh, okay.
I'd have to double check, but it's non-separation of these chromatid arms, and I think it's here.
Because does it come from the male or the female?
They say Downs is most commonly inherited from females because our eggs are coming from us from birth.
Right.
But they say that males can contribute to Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. But they say more likely it's a female.
Okay.
Alright, so spermiogenesis is a separate issue. It's not making, you know, a cell, or it's not basically going through reproduction, it's just making a cell streamlined. It is the last part of spermatogenesis. So I did want to mention this. You know, I said young sperm can make its way to an egg in about 45 minutes. Old men, their sperm are really slow, 2.5 days to get to the egg.
Oh, wow.
So Hugh Hefner.
Yeah. Sugar daddy.
Yeah. If Hugh Hefner had babies the natural way, then he had to have really good timing, you know. If she's ovulating in 2.5 days, then they had to have sex the right time to get those egg and sperm to meet up, so, yeah. So we've kind of covered 130. I didn't mention male secondary sex characteristics in the bottom of 130, but you want to look at those. And since we're looking at 130, let me point out inhibin. Inhibin is listed there under FSH and LH. And it says, you know, inhibin inhibits production of hormones in response to high levels of FSH. So is FSH the one responsible for testosterone or for spermatogenesis?
Spermatogenesis.
Yeah. So if you have, you know, if the body has too many sperm cells, then FSH is inhibited and we can reduce the number of sperm ultimately being produced in this process. So inhibin does exactly as its name implies. It inhibits more sperm production. You know, if a male does not ejaculate those sperm that are made every single day, they have to be carried off by a system that normally carries off escaped fluids. What system is that?
Lymphatic,
right. So that way, if those cells are not ejaculated, they're going to die, they're going to be phagocytized by white blood cells, and they're just transported off in the blood and the fluids to the bloodstream. Okie doke. So that should take us to 130. How about any questions on 129 or 130?
Just in case you're interested, there is a set of focus questions for the final exam on page 140, very last page. I know it would be nice if these were the exam questions.
Yeah.
They're more or less the topics you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I would definitely use page 140 when you're prepping for the final based on this chapter.
Are we going to have more questions on the reproductive system, or are they just going to be thrown in there?
Just thrown in there with the rest of the mix. And there is a quiz that will close, I want to say it's Tuesday at 11:59.
Yeah.
That'll help you with this.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to let you read over female's anatomy. It's pages 132 and 133. And instead, let's focus on making eggs, which is page 135. Something to appreciate here, male and female, you know, reproductive physiology looks very similar. We start with diploid spermatogonium in males, we start with diploid oogonium in females. And that oogonium undergoes mitosis, just like it does in males. And then we're going to start off here with primary oocytes. And in fact, that's what females are born with, is a set of primary oocytes that are basically her entire lifetime supply of egg cells.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is, they said, you know, originally that females are born with about 400,000 primary oocytes, and that's all she'll ever have. But there's actually been some research that shows maybe women can make more primary oocytes throughout their lifetime. So that'd be interesting to know, you know, if females can actually make more if necessary. So formed before birth, and that's what they're born with, is that supply of primary oocytes. So when females are born, you know, they grow up until, say, ages 11 to 14. Again, we're now looking at puberty happening earlier nowadays than it ever has before. So once females start undergoing puberty, they too experience an increase in GnRH, coming from where?
Hypothalamus,
and it targets the
pituitary.
Good. And then, of course, we make FSH and LH at puberty. That will start turning these primary oocytes into matured secondary oocytes. So every month, there are several primary oocytes at different stages of maturation. You know, you may have one that's going to be ovulated next month. You may have one that may be ovulated in 3 months down the road. So the interesting thing is, you know, whereas making sperm takes about 10 weeks, females, once they start maturing their eggs, takes actually several months to get there. So if you're ovulating an egg this month, it was probably started in production back in early January. So kind of interesting how that is not an immediate thing to get that cell ovulated. So primary oocytes, like primary spermatocytes, are diploid and they have a set of homologous chromosomes. We're going to undergo meiosis one. Let's strip down those chromosomes by half, and we're going to make a secondary oocyte. The polar body is actually a teeny tiny junk cell. We're going to donate all the cytoplasm and organelles that we can to that secondary oocyte. We need it to be big. It's got to drift for 7 days once it's fertilized.
Oh, okay.
So polar bodies, they say they can't be fertilized, and even if they were fertilized, I don't think they would live long enough to make their way to the uterus. So every month, a female will ovulate one of these secondary oocytes. That secondary oocyte is blistered off the surface of an ovary, and that secondary oocyte now travels down into the fallopian tube. The fimbriae of that fallopian tube actually don't touch the ovary, but there's a vacuum suction in there. What creates the suction? What organelle does this?
cilia.
Yeah.
So there are cilia inside the fallopian tube.
Please.
Yeah, I'm like, what?
Where is she going?
Yeah. So it creates basically a current that pulls that egg down into the fallopian tube. And of course, the sperm are attracted to the chemical odor that the egg emits. And so the sperm follow that egg into the fallopian tube. So that ovary, or rather that secondary oocyte, only lives for about 24 hours.
Can the egg ever, like, not go into the vacuum?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
There have been rare cases where the egg floats out into the pelvic cavity, and the sperm, because they're attracted to the chemical scent of the egg, follow. And there was a case of a woman, I want to say in England about 10 or 15 years ago, she had a egg fertilized by a sperm on the outside of her reproductive organs, and she also had a baby in her uterus. She had twins.
Ooh, wow.
And so your completely free thing happened.
Oh,
so they let her carry the baby to full term, but if it was not delivered by C-section, then she would have had basically a dead baby inside of her body that she could not birth.
So yeah. How did it grow outside of her?
Very, very carefully. It attached a blood supply to the outside of an organ, and surprisingly, it didn't cause her to have a hemorrhage and die.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That is
crazy.
Like, if the baby's outside and it's not doing well, can
that make
you see?
I guess, yeah, because there was a case in India of a woman whose baby was outside. She had labor pains. It was trying to be born, and it became basically a dead baby in her body outside
mm-hmm.
of her uterus, and
mm-hmm.
it became a hard rock.
Yeah, because I thought even if the baby dies in your uterus, it can make you sick.
That can make you sick,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Yeah, that's how
yeah.
it can, as we talk to the
comparisons. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, so, but to answer your question, yeah, those eggs can drift out and the sperm will follow, and then they've got a problem. Yeah. I think it's extremely rare for that to happen. So, but if fertilization does occur in that fallopian tube and implantation follows, then we've got an ectopic pregnancy. So,
yeah.
Also dangerous. So 24 hours is it. That's as long as the secondary oocyte lives. And it's amazing to think that with that 24-hour window, as many people are born as are, but 24 hours is all it takes. But those sperm can live around 2 to 3 days max. So there gives us a 3 days sex before ovulation up to a day after. So it gives you about a 4, maybe stretching it to a 5 day window there, to being generous, that a sexual event could occur and still have fertilization of that oocyte. So if this was the end of our story, that means no fertilization occurs, we would just stop right now and that would be the end of our discussion. Basically, after 24 hours, that oocyte would die. It's drifting out in females' vaginal fluids, and it's gone. She never has any idea she's lost her oocyte. So that would be the end of our story at this point. Now, let's consider that if that oocyte is fertilized, I'm going to take you down below the dotted line. If it's fertilized, there's our sperm nucleus. We're going to change the name of the oocyte when it's fertilized to an ovum. So the word ovum says to me, this has been a fertilized cell. I think it's funny that female eggs work this way. Female eggs pause at secondary oocyte level. That's only having completed meiosis one. They start into meiosis two and they don't bother to complete it. It's kind of like, if there's no sperm here, why should I waste my time finishing the process? So they hang out and they pause in meiosis two. That may be where they stop, because if fertilization doesn't occur, this is the end of our story. But if fertilization occurs and a sperm is making its way inside that egg, that oocyte will complete meiosis II, and now it's going to junk off that extra set of DNA into yet another little tiny polar body. So keep in mind, we've got to take that double-stranded chromosome, we've got to get rid of half that DNA and take it down to a single-stranded chromosome. Thank you. egg nucleus and sperm nucleus will eventually fuse. I believe it's a few hours' time that they sit separate, and then eventually the two nuclei fuse. And when that happens, we are now back to a zygote, which is a diploid 2N cell. That zygote will undergo rapid cell division, which is mitosis. It will drift from the fallopian tube, where this fertilization occurs, down into the uterus. And the trip takes about 7 days to find a suitable home. By the time this zygote has reached the uterus, it's going to become a ball of cells, kind of looks like a soccer ball, and it will test the waters, trying to find a suitable place to implant inside the endometrium of the uterus. If the hormone levels are right, if the endometrial lining is thick enough, it will burrow in and start drawing nutrition from the mother through that endometrial lining. So if there is not a suitable environment or the conditions aren't right, then this little ball of cells is going to basically just die and drift out of the female's vaginal fluids. She'll never have any idea that she was actually pregnant for a short period of time, and the woman goes on and has her period in a few more days just as normal. So she would never have any clue that she had been pregnant for a short time period. Okay, so only complete meiosis II if there has been a fertilization event. Otherwise, we pause and stop there with that secondary oocyte. Okay, so I think it's worthy to lay these two side by side so you can see how these processes are similar. We start with an oogonium or a spermatogonium. We take you to a primary cell, a secondary cell, and then we finally get the mature cells down here at the bottom. We undergo mitosis, then meiosis I, then meiosis II. The goal is to produce how many sex cells in a male?
Four.
And are they diploid or haploid?
Diploid.
Right. And in a female, we produce only one secondary oocyte. Is it diploid or haploid?
Haploid.
It's haploid. Yeah, so the catch is, of course, it'll finish meiosis II if it has to be, you know, fertilized. All right, so how about questions on this stuff so far?
Did you
get
a blood
Why it takes 24 hours? That's as long as the oocyte lives. It just has a 24-hour lifetime. Let's see, we talked about FSH and LH on page 136. I do want to mention estrogen and progesterone, but I'll mention it by talking about that chart on page 138. There is a ovarian menstrual cycle pictured there. We're going to go over to 138. I wanted to show you this picture because an egg is not just an egg by itself. An egg comes with a posse. It has a protective ring of cells around it that we call a follicle. And all of these cells sticking out around here come with that oocyte when it's ovulated off the surface of an ovary. And this ovary, you can see how the oocyte blisters off the surface. So that's how ovulation occurs, is a matured oocyte is blistered off the surface, and then it's vacuum suctioned down into that fallopian tube. So an older woman who's gone through many cycles is going to have a very blistered-looking ovary. A young woman who's just starting her menstrual cycles will have a rather clean, smooth-looking ovary on the outside surface. All right, so let's talk about these pictures. On the top here, you've got two sets of hormones. You've got the anterior pituitary hormones at the very top, FSH and LH, and then we've got estrogens and progesterone. Those two are made by the ovary. Down below, we've got an ovarian cycle. Basically, it's tracking what's happening with your follicle and the oocyte that was ovulated. And on the bottom, we have a menstrual cycle, which tracks the changes of the uterus. So oftentimes, we talk about the menstrual cycle, but those two cycles, menstrual and ovarian cycle, are actually tied together. So the uterus is kind of like a slave to the ovary. Whatever the ovary says do, the uterus will follow suit. So even when women go through menopause in their 50s,
All that means is their ovaries are no longer being the director over the uterus. You can take an 80-year-old woman, if you want to, and tell her uterus it's time to make a baby, and it will listen and do it. So that's how they have women in their 60s and 70s give birth to babies. They've turned that uterus back on as a reproductive organ. Doesn't matter that their ovaries are dead. They can do it artificially and get the uterus to then behave once again under the direction of those hormones.
Wow.
Yeah, scary stuff.
Yeah.
Don't want a baby at 60, no. Or 80. So the typical cycle is 28 days in length, and I say typical. I didn't say the word normal because it varies from woman to woman, and even for a single female, 1 month she may have 28 days in her cycle, the next month 30, the next month 29, the next month 28. So it does vary from woman to woman and even for a female's own cycle. The first 5 days, though, for most people, on average, somewhere between 3 and 5 days, is a menstrual flow, and we call that the period. And what part of the uterus is removed from the body during that time period? Endometrium, right? Okay, so the endometrial lining is sloughed off, and then you'll notice in the proliferative phase, which is around days 5 to 14, the lining begins to thicken. Even after day 14, the lining of the uterus continues to get thicker, anticipating what?
Implantation,
yeah, pregnancy. So I kind of think the uterus is funny. The uterus is playing house every month. It says, maybe this month the baby will be here. And you have a period, and then it gets thicker and thicker and thicker, and it says, finally by day 28, it realizes, oh, not this month. So it cleans house, and it starts all over, yeah. So every month your uterus as a female is playing house, getting ready for the baby that never comes. Okay, so let's talk about the ovarian cycle up there. The ovaries are making a mature secondary oocyte once a month. And around what day is that secondary oocyte ovulated? About day 14, okay? So around day 14, ovulation occurs, and that secondary oocyte is vacuum suctioned into what tube?
Fallopian
tube. And that's where fertilization will occur. And if it occurs there, then we expect in about 7 days after that, implantation, excuse me, in the uterus. So that means around day 21 of a female cycle, she may have a little bit of spotting and maybe some cramping when implantation occurs. Notice how thick that uterus is about that time period. Let's also take a look at the hormones. Up at the very top, what happens to LH and FSH right before day 14?
They spike.
And because LH and FSH turn on estrogens and progesterones, that's going to encourage ovulation here about a day or so later with day 14. So you'll notice that estrogen was peaking about the same time, and then after day 14, progesterone begins to peak. You'll notice progesterone is prevalent during the second half of a female cycle. This is called the secretory phase. And look at the level of progesterone compared to the thickness of the uterus. What is progesterone helping the uterus do?
Build
a thick layer. Yeah, so progesterone is actually the hormone that helps maintain pregnancy. So this is when your uterus is playing house and thinking that a baby may be coming to visit. And then, of course, it realizes nothing's happening. So hormone levels drop around day 28. And, of course, the uterus begins to die. And then we start the whole process once again. So when those hormone levels tend to dip off, that's when women have, you know, cramping. We tend to see things like PMS, mood changes. Water retention actually comes from these hormones.
These, like a swallow worm.
Yeah, exactly. These are steroids, so they make us swell. So when those hormone levels drop, then we tend to lose fluids and all that swelling tends to go away. So this cycle here is something that continues from menarche, which is the time a female begins her menstrual cycle, at puberty, and it tends to end in the mid-50s when we see women undergo menopause. So about a 40-year time period that women are technically fertile and can produce children. So they say around age 51 is the average age of menopause, although it can occur later or earlier than that time period. Okay, so that should give you a rundown of pages 137 with the picture there on page 138. Don't forget about page 140. What part of this can I go back and hit again for you? Have been my favorite 211.
Aww.
You all have been awesome.
He's so sweet.
You give me energy, you feedback, you talk, you ask questions, you're involved, you're interested, and that's great because then you know I can provide you guys with more. So I really enjoyed having you this semester. I wish you lots of luck. I hope you get good news about your programs for fall semester.
Yes.
And I'm down the hall in 5416. If I can ever be of any help to you, you know, please let me know. Okay. Thank you.
So you know you're not gonna have to repeat none of us. You're not gonna see us again.
She let us know it's been good to see you.
It's been good to see you, that's right.
So
you don't teach my girl?
I don't, that's Mr. Pritchett's baby. Yeah. Yeah. He's been here for over 40 years and any questions for upcoming final? Any questions on this stuff that I can hit again?
For the final, what is the main subject that we, like, it's just, I'm merely on it.
It's a sample of everything, and I tell you what, I find most people forget the endocrine system because it was first.
Mm-hmm.
I hit that.
Yeah.
I'd go back and hit blood typing, I'd hit blood, I'd hit heart and blood vessels. And then from that point forward, most people tend to remember stuff.
You think we should go back and review our charts, like the charts we're talking about, like BOP and increasing and decreasing?
Only if you need it. If you can answer test questions on it, then I wouldn't go back and review those charts.
Yeah.
Well, I'll get Lauren, then I'll get you.
Will it have equal number of questions from each, like about the same number of questions?
Yeah. Okay. So don't think about like lymphatic having a ton of questions. It'll have the same amount as we
spent time-wise on.
Yeah, basically. So if you spend a ton of time on a chapter, there are going to be more questions on that. Yeah.
How do we
do
this?
Draw yourself out a nephron and then put what's reabsorbed in the PCT, lupopenly DCT, and then put on your what is secreted. And that may be a flashcard that you can make also. And don't worry too much about it. It's like one or two questions on the whole test. Yeah.
And the rest of our
look a little bit at anatomy, look a little bit at O2 hemoglobin curve, pulmonary ventilation. There's one question on each of those topics. So it's not a huge thing to stress over.
Okay.
All right, y'all good to go?
Yeah.
All right, I will see you on Tuesday.
Yeah.